It's October 1969. It's late, and Charlie Klein is sitting in front of a massive computer called the SDS Sigma 7. Charlie is a student at UCLA. He's tired, he's hungry, and he's hell-bent on doing one thing before calling it a night. Something you and I do a million times a day without even thinking about it. He wants to send a message from one computer to another. Charlie is using the Sigma 7 with a brand new government-funded program called ARPANET, and he's trying to connect with another giant computer at Stanford. Charlie enters his message into the Sigma 7 and sends it. Hundreds of miles away, Stanford's computer receives the message one letter at a time. L. O. Before the next letter can appear, Charlie's system crashes. Even the custom air-conditioned flooring can't keep his hulking, apartment-sized computer from overheating. An hour later, the full message finally goes through. L-O-G-I-N. With that, Charlie goes to get a late-night snack, a small reward for changing the way we communicate forever. I'm Mike Masnick, and this is Otherwise Objectionable, the true story of Section 230, the most misunderstood law on the internet. In this episode, we're going back to the birth of the World Wide Web.
And that's where the expression, information wants to be free, was coined.
We'll explore the platforms and bulletin boards of Web 1.0 and see how they became a battleground in the war between online moderation and free speech on the internet.
All of a sudden, the level of the signal-to-noise ratio in the discourse dropped, but worse than that was just the spam.
And we'll meet the lawmakers who saw the chaos and came up with a solution.
We weren't Nostradamus-like, but certain things were pretty clear even back in 1996.
Let's go back to 1957. America's military and scientific communities are suddenly put on red alert. Why? The Soviet Union just launched Sputnik.
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket. You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite.
I am going to lay the facts before you, the rough with the smooth. Some of these security facts are reassuring. Others are not. They are sternly demanding.
Fast forward to 1962. An American psychologist named J.C.R. Licklider comes up with the idea for an interconnected network. He predicts that soon, man and computer will have a highly interactive relationship. His work becomes the basis for the Advanced Research Projects Agency Network, more commonly abbreviated to ARPANET. In 1969, just a handful of places are connected by ARPANET, mostly government agencies and universities working on government-funded projects. Our friend Charlie Klein at UCLA sends his first message, L-O. You'd think the clear next step would be email, but even that takes two more years, and you can thank Ray Tomlinson for your overflowing inbox. And even then, it takes more than a decade to develop the common protocols and standards that govern what we now call the internet, whose official birthday is January 1st, 1983, in case you want to send it a card. Driving all these pioneers was a desire to connect, share resources freely, and learn from each other.
The internet was built on open principles.
Stephen Levy has been covering the internet since its infancy. Stephen was a young reporter right around when all this was happening. And at the time, the internet wasn't on anyone's radar.
I was writing about anything, sports and crime and culture and music.
In 1980, Stephen moved from Philadelphia to New York with his girlfriend, now wife. She was writing for the Village Voice, and he was a struggling freelancer.
And a former editor of my wife's was working for Jane Fonda, her film production company. And they were coming up with ideas and giving them to magazine writers so they could option them in advance. So the idea that she approached me with was to write about computer hackers, hackers in the creative sense, not in the, transgressive sense.
Through the 60s and the 70s, while J.C.R. Licklider and Ray Tomlinson and all those experts were laying the foundation of the internet, there was another group at work under the radar. In the background of all the official government-sanctioned work, students at MIT and universities across the country were doing their own work on ARPANET. Bright minds like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and other self-described hackers. They were no names at the time, but Stephen was a young journalist looking for his next big story.
I'd never touched the computer before that, but I said, sure, I'll do it. I managed to get myself an account on MIT for some reason and was using it. And in reporting that story, I discovered this world. Everything I knew about computers was wrong. These people were really interesting, and the whole field was really exciting. And the big pivot for me was coming across the culture of MIT in the late 50s and early 60s.
Well, all of these techniques, including the graphical manipulation, will make it much easier in the future for the man to dynamically converse with a computer.
And what I learned there was that they had built this whole culture, which really turned out to be computer culture, based on open sharing. Everything should be shared. No one could hoard information. Getting access to computers was at the center of their existence. And it was a way of thinking that really fascinated me. And I documented that in the book and took it through different generations of hackers, that original hacker culture at MIT, and then the culture that from which the personal computer industry sprang, the Homebrew Computer Club, and Apple Computer was part of that.
A lot of where Apple came from had a lot of the hacker ethic in it, a lot of purity about information should be shared.
That is Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple with Steve Jobs.
Pass it around. Let other people look at what you've done and try to build on it and do a little bit better. Make the information, the code, the listings, the schematics very public because people can take advantage of it and do a little more. And that's the right way for the hacker ethic.
That hacker ethic Steve Wozniak was talking about is exactly what Stephen Levy was writing about in his book. It came out in 1984, just a year after the internet was officially born. And appropriately enough, he threw a party.
Steve Wozniak came and some of the MIT hackers and some of the people I wrote about in the, you know, in the game world and the Mac team came. And these ideas were just bubbling through. And that's where the expression information wants to be free was coined. In hackers, I wrote as one of the parts of the hacker ethic, information should be free. But in a conversation between Stuart Brand and Steve Wozniak, Stuart kind of hacked it to that, and Steve Wozniak says, well, information wants to be free, but it also wants to be expensive. So it was kind of an historic event.
Information wants to be free. That ethos runs through all the other historic events that led up to that moment, back to that kid at UCLA sending that first message. Those early leaders in computing and tech cared much more about open communication and the free exchange of ideas. Decades later, Section 230 would provide the legal framework to uphold those values, making sure the communication revolution wouldn't collapse under the weight of a million lawsuits. Unfortunately, in case you forgot, that spirit of unrestricted dialogue is no longer a given, but we'll get to that soon enough.
So the whole infrastructure of the internet was in the spirit of those hackers.
To get where we're going, the internet first had to leave its ivory tower and get inside the nation's homes. But is the web ready for its public debut?
Cool.
Splendid.
First of all, good to see you. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it has. I think the last time was in London maybe a decade or two ago.
A few weeks ago, I caught up with one of my oldest internet friends.
My name is Andrew Bullhack. For work, I'm a computer toucher.
Andrew is a software engineer who's worked at places like Spotify and The Guardian.
My earliest memories of using the internet was when I arrived at university in 1992, and they had some kind of terminal app that connected to these time-sharing machines, which were basically deck station workstations. In first year, we didn't get those, but there was an old one of those, which was a sort of student machine. They gave it to a group of students to run, and it was a deck station 2100, which later I found out is about a similar architecture to the Sony PlayStation 1, only less capable. And every lunchtime, hundreds of students would try to log into that, and it would take about 15 minutes to get in. But once you were in, you had email, you had IRC and various types of real-time chat, and various people took to that like a duck to water. And I mean, my great discovery there was Usenet.
That's where I met Andrew. Like most early users, I got on Usenet via my own university. It was given to me on a floppy disk that they handed out at orientation, along with email and a bunch of other programs that really don't exist anymore. And when I got on Usenet, I discovered that there were news groups on every topic you could imagine under the sun.
All of a sudden, there were all these groups where people were talking about cool, weird stuff like conspiracy theories and various sorts of online memes and just random bizarreness and computer history. And whereas in the real world, people were just talking just the random sort of gossip that people physically near each other talk. So above a certain degree of nerdiness, you tend to go towards the spaces where people talk about ideas and stuff.
The internet rocked my world within just a couple of years. It completely changed how I approached my connections to the world.
That's Eric Goldman, the Silicon Valley law professor you heard in the last episode. Back in the days when long-distance calls cost a small fortune, the internet opened up his world.
Bulletin board services blew my mind. There were these places I could virtually go to where I could have conversations with people I didn't even know, talk to people in ways that that I never felt comfortable doing before. I could have these cost-free, geographically unrestricted conversations. And as I thought about what that meant for the world, as people started to be able to reach audiences beyond their physical social network, I just got really excited by that potential. It seemed to me that that was going to enable a whole new set of beneficial social activities that had been foreclosed by the high costs of communication in the offline world.
Eric, myself, and anyone who touched the early internet, we were energized by the seemingly endless amount of user-generated content. We were having eye-opening conversations and accessing resources we could never have afforded before. But there was also just a lot of fun and new friendships.
I think I found alt.conspiracy on Usenet. My first post, I think, was to there and was basically I was asking whether there was anything mysterious about the death of H.P. Lovecraft. Half facetiously, half... I can't remember if I was serious or facetious, but and finding there were people interested in that. After a while, I petitioned for the newsgroup alt.discordia to be created for that, and that became a sort of online community. And I met quite a few people there, quite a few good friends I've stayed in touch with, usually various sorts of copacetic weird nerds.
myself included, I think. I actually didn't realize that you helped create alt.discordia, because that is where I found you.
Yeah, I somehow managed to finagle an account under a pseudonym. I used in Discordianism, there was this thing about having these sort of baroquely pseudo-religious names. And for some reason, I stumbled on the not entirely original name, Lee Harvey Oswald Smith. And I got an account created somewhere with those initials. And I used that to get the group set up and post to it.
Alt.discordia was an online community that was almost impossible to describe. It was just a group of people having sort of an inside joke around a book, and it was a moment in time.
I mean, it was kind of a sheltered environment, so it was it did tend to be an easygoing kind of place. There wasn't any sort of degree of aggression or griefing or any of the... I mean, there was trolling, but trolling back then was defined quite differently. It was basically getting people to believe something silly, like, did you know that Star Trek was actually filmed in space or something like that? Or saying something that's obviously wrong and getting them to trip over it and correct you, and them being the only person who wasn't in on the joke. So trolling was not entirely gentle, but a whole lot less aggressively stupid.
But one day, early users like Andrew, Eric, and myself started to notice a strange disturbance of the ecosystem. It eventually became known as the September that never ended.
Usenet was originally on the ARPANET internet, which was a closed system with mostly universities and research institutions. And every year in September, they'd get an influx of newly signed in students. In September, there'd all be all these clueless newbies stumbling around for a while, making all these faux pas. And of course, September never ended meant there was a constant influx of newcomers. And I mean, it was considerably larger than the student intake every year. So there were a lot of people who just got their AOL cover discs and just posted in all caps about asking some question, completely oblivious to which forum they were posting to. And if there were one or two of those, I mean, it would have been easy enough to handle, but there were large numbers of them. So that's what they called the September that never ended.
Once the horse was out of the barn, there was no getting it back in. Fast forward to 1993, and the first AOL discs were being sent out. Platforms that were a little more user-friendly than Usenet were popping up, and the old guard was starting to notice problems.
When the September that never ended came in and Usenet sort of became flooded, I mean, that was a bit of a shock because all of a sudden the level of the signal-to-noise ratio in the discourse dropped and the quality of discourse deteriorated. But worse than that was just the spam. I mean, the economics meant you could send millions of messages about your get-rich-quick scam or dodgy website or whatever, and even if one person bit the bait, then you'd come in ahead.
Usenet was a chaotic mess.
Eric Goldman once went to Usenet for all things, and now it was unsustainable. Other platforms experienced influxes too. Moderators faced a new set of challenges and no rules or laws to steer them. And the sheer volume of user-generated content, all that glorious information flowing freely, suddenly became a problem.
Back in the 1990s, there was a lot of discussion about the idea that we could disintermediate conversations, that every major communication technology had some form of intermediation, usually by a small oligopoly or monopoly provider, and that those people had too much control over the conversations that could take place. And the internet tantalized us with the possibility that we could get rid of all these people in the middle and just talk to each other and just be ourselves and learn from each other and grow with each other without the control of these people in the middle. And what we learned, I think, quickly, certainly I learned quickly, is that we absolutely wanted people in the middle of the conversations, because without that, the conversations became too noisy or became sidetracked or worse, became filled with harmful content.
Maybe it was time to go back to the hacker ethic. Was there a solution that could maintain the spirit of information should be free, but also kept bad actors in check? Without a fix, scammers and harmful content were flooding platforms. The internet needed someone to step up before someone got hurt.
So we knew we were legislating, in front of the Grand Canyon, as it were. Yes, I am Christopher Cox. You can call me Chris.
Chris Cox is the former chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and from 1988 to 2005, he was a member of the House of Representatives.
And for purposes of this discussion, the author, with my co-author, Ron Wyden from Oregon, of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act.
In the early days of the internet, Chris was uniquely qualified to help Congress understand this groundbreaking new technology.
I had a very interesting company that I co-founded in the 1980s that translated the Soviet Union's largest daily newspaper, Pravda, into English, and we distributed that in 26 countries around the world. When I ran for Congress, I actually coded the software for my database and continued to do that throughout all my years in Congress. So I'd say that compared to other people, I was a little bit more on the bleeding edge of things. You know, majority of the members of the Senate at the time, someone took a poll, did not have email. The internet was a new thing, and people were still answering all of their congressional mail on paper.
But Chris knew what people like me and Andrew were doing. He saw just how big the internet was going to get.
We weren't Nostradamus-like back then, but certain things were pretty clear even back in the day. The World Wide Web, and its leading destinations had millions of users at the time. And millions so distinguished it from, the local newspaper or what have you.
That distinction was a tricky issue for some lawmakers. There were no legal guardrails for this new digital landscape. And early internet moderators were already battling spam and scams at alarming rates. If all that user-generated content triggered something bad, who would be held responsible?
There's different liability standards for different actors in the market, right?
That's Jessica Malugin, head of the Center for Technology and Innovation at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. As she explains it, there wasn't really a legal precedent for the internet.
So there's distributors, newsstand, bookstores, libraries, retailers. They don't have a lot of editorial control over the products they sell, so they have limited liability. Publishers, newspapers, books, magazines, advertisements. They're in control of that content, so they're very responsible legally for that content. Well, here comes message boards on the internet, and the question becomes for those operating them, or at least their general counsels, which one? Who do you sue?
So CompuServe was the first to get sued for content that someone else created.
Jeff Kossoff is a cyber law expert and the author of a book on Section 230.
CompuServe had a fairly hands-off approach to user content. They had chat rooms, bulletin boards, and they did some contracting out for some third-party content. But CompuServe, the company, did not get involved in what would be known today as content moderation.
This led pretty quickly to some problems.
So there was a journalism newsletter that a third-party contractor had posted on a CompuServe bulletin board that made some allegations about a former TV journalist and his job. That former journalist said the allegations were false, so he sued CompuServe.
In 1991, the creators of a media industry news service called Scuttlebutt got in a fight with CompuServe's own media industry news service called Rumorville. Rumorville had published a newsletter calling Scuttlebutt a scam and suggesting its creator had been fired by his previous employer and had scooped Rumorville by some devious means. The Scuttlebutt creators sued, claiming the post was false and defamatory. The case was called Cubby v. CompuServe, but I think Scuttlebutt v. Rumorville would have been a lot more fun.
So the question was, is CompuServe a publisher and they're responsible because they're hosting that and distributing that and publishing that? Are they a publisher?
And CompuServe said, you know, we are the equivalent of a newsstand. We don't edit content. We're not a newspaper. We just sell content. And they pointed to some cases that had been decided all the way back to the 1950s that said that newsstands and bookstores are only liable if they knew or had reason to know of the defamatory content.
This case was Smith versus California from way back in 1959. CompuServe said there's no evidence to show that they were aware of this defamatory post since they don't moderate at all.
And the court said they haven't been curating that site. They haven't been looking through all the posts and removing things that might be offensive or spam or whatever. So they're just more, they're acting more like a distributor. They're passive and they're off the hook.
In a fairly straightforward and pretty short opinion, the federal judge in Manhattan said CompuServe is the digital equivalent of a newsstand and the case is dismissed.
And as great as that outcome might seem for internet pioneers and lovers of free information, it had a pretty big unintended consequence.
So that's part of what triggered this disincentive for platforms or message boards at the time to say, we're not going to take anything down. We're not even going to look at it. We're just going to ignore it, turn a blind eye, because we don't want to be on the legal hook for the thing that comes up as liable in court. So it just created this incentive to not take kind of nasty stuff down or anything down.
I was on my weekly commute between California and Washington, D.C., flying back and forth, as members of Congress do, reading, as I recall, the Wall Street Journal, and a news story about a lawsuit.
Being a true techie, Chris Cox saw that the Cubby decision would not hold up with the internet growing as fast as it was. Remember, this was in the middle of the September that never ended.
CompuServe was not responsible for something illegal that somebody had said online because they hadn't made any effort to moderate that content. They hadn't gotten involved in editing it in any way. They were like a library, and librarians are not responsible for what's in the books. But the law was not designed for, you know, a newspaper that got millions of pieces of content in a very short period of time and that published it in real time.
An endless stream of information, opinions, and content completely unfiltered and unmoderated. That would be hard for pretty much anyone to stomach.
And so looking at this case and seeing and imagining what would be the consequence, I had plenty of time to think about it on that airplane ride. And so I sketched out on a yellow legal pad, you know, the beginnings of what became Section 230.
What came next was something the internet's founders could only dream of, a revolution of open information and connection. Whatever his intention, Chris Cox's sketch gave birth to all the user reviews, YouTube tutorials, and other tools that have grown in the spirit of the free flow of information. But the road to the internet that we know now was bumpy.
I suspect this new internet deal was going to have zillions of posters. So how in the world would anybody be able to track all this stuff down?
We needed the best thinkers to think about this because this really was a new problem.
I was an unknown lawyer, and Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street, said, "Jake, I've got a tough case for you."